We'll talk about the history of the cigarette this hour, the role the cigarette has had on our culture, and the harm caused by cigarettes. 100 million people died of smoking-related diseases in the 20th century, and in the next 100 years, it's predicted that there will be 1 billion deaths worldwide. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, April the 23rd. And we will welcome in the author of The Cigarette Century this hour, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. And we will welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Alan Brandt is the Koss Professor of History of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He holds a joint appointment in the Department of History of Science at Harvard. His work focuses on social and ethical aspects of health, disease, and medical practices in the United States. He is the author of The Cigarette Century, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So that's why did you decide to look into the history of the cigarette?
Well, it's had such a giant impact on human health over the last 100 years in the United States and around the world. And it now threatens to have even a more serious impact on health and disease in the coming 100 years. So I thought it was an important area for historical investigation.
Yeah. So how long have cigarettes been around? Only a century?
Well, we think of the cigarette as having been around almost forever.
Mm-hmm.
But really was invented in the late 19th century in its modern form. It was only with the introduction of mass rolling technology that the industry could produce literally hundreds of thousands of cigarettes in a day, and then it perfected intensive marketing techniques in a new consumer culture in the early 20th century.
Yeah, so what kind of reputation did cigarettes have back then?
Well, there was always a series of questions about cigarettes, both on moral and on medical grounds. And there were people who thought cigarettes were very wasteful and inappropriate from a moral perspective. But there was always a great deal of medical concern about the idea of taking smoke into your lungs and what the health impacts might be.
Yeah, well, it seems intuitive that if you suck in smoke, that can't be good for you.
Well, and it's not. But it was unclear for a number of years just how bad it really was. And there was also this perception that perhaps some people could smoke without dire impacts, but other people probably shouldn't. So it was a sort of clinical assessment. Perhaps some people shouldn't smoke. But by the early 20th century, there was a rising level of lung cancer. And so many physicians and people in public health began to associate that rise with the striking rise in cigarette consumption that had occurred about 10 to 20 years earlier.
Yeah, so a percentage of population smoking in the early days or at that time?
Well, it's really amazing. Only 50 cigarettes were smoked per capita as recently as 1900, 2 or 3% of the population. By the end of the First World War, a lot of men had begun to smoke. And by the middle of the 20th century, nearly half of all adults were regular smokers.
All right. So how did, I know you wrote a whole book on it, but how did that rise occur in consumption of cigarettes?
Well, it's really one of the big stories in the history of our consumer culture, the rise of national brands, the rise of Madison Avenue, the rise of aggressive promotion and public relations. So all of these elements were crucial to building this major market of cigarette users. And partly what I argue in the book is that the tobacco industry was a major innovator in all of the forces that drive consumption in the 20th century.
I'm sorry, who was a major innovator?
The tobacco industry.
Mm-hmm.
They perfected modern advertising. They looked at how to get women to smoke when women weren't smoking. They learned how to use public relations to get their product into the news. They perfected the idea of getting their product into films and into other powerfully influential cultural idiom. So really, this was an industry that was figuring out consumption in a really brilliant way early in the 20th century.
Yeah. Well, my father was a smoker. He probably took it up before World War II, but didn't the military distribute free cigarettes, and didn't that influence the consumption of cigarettes?
Absolutely. The military said it's crucial for morale. And going all the way back to the First World War, General Pershing, who led the war effort, said tobacco is as important as bullets for the success of our war effort. Mm-hmm. So many young men went into the service and came out addicted to nicotine, and it's a story that's important in both world wars.
Yeah, brought up my father because he was you know, lucky strike smoker for the most part, and I remember there's actually ads at the time that lucky strikes were good for your health, that somehow that was going to, you know, help your throat, and it was smooth smoke that was going to be healthful.
Well, I think all the brands were really promoted as being mild, less irritating. Mm-hmm. One of the competitive aspects of tobacco advertising in the early 20th century was to say, if you're finding this cigarette is causing coughs or irritation, change to our brand, which is mild. And in fact, Camels, for example, would claim, they're so mild you can smoke all you want. So as physicians were telling patients, maybe you should cut back a little bit, the industry was interceding to say, "Oh, don't worry about it. You can smoke all the tobacco you want."
Yeah, and I think he switched to Camels too. So maybe
he may well have been influenced by those very campaigns.
So you tell the story in the introduction about how when you were a little boy and saw this huge billboard of what was it? It was a Camel.
It was a Camel man.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, this is one of the most famous billboards in American history, and it sat in Times Square from really during the period of World War II right into the mid-1960s. And you probably have some listeners who are old enough to remember this. It blew these big steam smoke rings into the sky above Times Square. And I saw it when I was 7 years old, and it really had a big impact on me. I wanted to know, how did it work? I thought it was the coolest thing I had ever seen. And in some ways, reflecting back now, I realized that the industry always had almost a direct route into a child's mentality. And they really understood what would appeal to kids. And certainly this sign appealed to me tremendously on my first visit to New York City.
You know, Leo Duran, my producer, pulled a few clips of some old TV ads, maybe radio ads, too, for cigarettes, because we knew we were doing this program. And I was shocked with one that he found, because while I know about some of the modern advertising, I'd never known that Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble were spokespeople for Winston Cigarettes.
That's right.
And here, let me just play. This is just amazing. This is, I think, at the end of the cartoon that that viewers would see this.
Gee, we ought to do something, Fred.
Okay.
How's about taking a nap? Hey, I got a better idea. Let's take a Winston break.
That's it. Winston is the one filter cigarette that delivers flavor 20 times a pack. Winston's got that filter blend.
The Flintstone has been brought to you by Winston, America's best-selling, best-tasting filter cigarette.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
He kind of sounded like Homer Simpson there for a second, but that is, I had no idea that the Flintstones were hawking Winstons.
Well, the industry did everything to get everyone to hawk their product, and those of your listeners who remember the Flintstones remember families gathered up around the television set late 50s, early 60s, and here you would watch cartoon characters promoting cigarettes. And clearly, this was about reaching a youth market, and the industry's always been committed to reaching out to youth to try to make them smokers.
Yeah, and more recent example of that, the Joe Camel, the cartoon Camel, to push the cigarettes.
Well, that's right. Mm-hmm. And I asked myself during the Joe Camel campaign, which was partly when I was working on the book in the late 80s, early 90s, why is R.J. Reynolds running a campaign with a cartoon character, which was taking so much criticism in the media? And there were editorials and opinion pieces throughout the media saying, Reynolds should pull the campaign because they know it appeals to kids, but they stuck with it. And what we now know from internal industry documents is that Reynolds stuck with it because they had to get into the youth market to compete successfully with Philip Morris and Marlboro's. So it was really, in spite of the criticism, they stayed with it because they knew it worked and it would appeal to young smokers.
We're talking with Alan Brandt. He is the author of The Cigarette Century, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Alan Brandt is a professor of the history of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He also holds a joint appointment in the Department of the History of Science at Harvard. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Virginia Slims. This is the taste for today's woman. With rich Virginia flavor you'll like. Tailored slim for your hands, for your lips. Virginia Slims.
You got Virginia Slims now, baby. You've come a long, long way.
And that was a commercial for Virginia Slims cigarettes. I think that was playing around the time that I was going out behind the garage. Talking about the role of the cigarette in our country during this century and of the history of the cigarette. Welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, Alan Brandt, author of The Cigarette Century. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. So, Professor Brandt, women having their own cigarettes, they came a long way, huh?
Well, this was another brilliant strategy that referred back to the campaigns in the 1920s and 1930s. When one of the fathers of American public relations, Edward Bernays, said that cigarettes will be torches of freedom for emancipated women, and developed a publicity stunt where he got women to smoke during the Easter parade in 1928, arranged to have photographers there, and it became a big controversial news story, and was one of the signal events in helping to make women smokers in the 20th century. And then this was followed up by Philip Morris in the 1960s and 70s with the Virginia Slims campaign.
Just amazing. We have a number of callers who want to talk with you. And first is Jerry in Genesee Depot. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yes. Again, we're hearing about smoking being detrimental to our health. I came from a family of smokers. I didn't smoke. But by the same token, I think we're stressing something that may not be any more important than overeating. We're always avoiding the really big problem of liquor, and I don't know why that seems to keep on happening, except maybe the lobbies are stronger for one thing or another. I'm certainly concerned about smoking, but by the same token, I'm not as concerned about it as the impact on the whole world, because we certainly are getting more population every day than we did before, and we're dying of many other causes, too. So that's my word.
Overreacting to cigarettes, Professor Brandt?
Well, I don't think so. Cigarettes are the leading preventable cause of death in the United States today. Over 430,000 people die of tobacco-related diseases in this country alone every year, and that's more than auto accidents, AIDS, illicit drugs, suicides, and homicides combined. So I think it's a giant public health problem. It's not to deny that there are other important health problems, and alcohol-related diseases would be one of them. Obesity and the diseases associated with obesity are a tremendous problem in our country. So we have many, many issues to take up, but the cigarette is a gigantic cause of unnecessary disease.
Jerry mentioned that he thought that maybe the I don't know, that alcohol wasn't getting negative attention because their lobbyists are stronger. However, the lobbyists for the cigarette industry haven't been too shabby, have they?
Well, one of the things I argue in the book is that the tobacco industry really invented special interest lobbying as we know it today. And obviously, there's a lot of concern about the influence that big businesses have on our political activity and on our democracy. But the tobacco industry, starting early on, had the highest paid lobbyists. They would hire former congressmen and senators to run their lobbying operation. And they were tremendously effective in fighting serious regulatory legislation. So I think if we want to understand how businesses influence politics, looking at tobacco is one good way to go.
Yeah. Louise in Spring Green is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I hope your guest can check my memory, but as a teenager who started smoking at the first opportunity to do it legally at age 13 in Minnesota, I remember seeing ads that had people either dressed as doctors, claiming to be doctors, dressed in lab coats, touting cigarettes on the back of Life magazine, you know, big, full-color ads. Is my memory faulty, or was...
You are absolutely right. And one of the most popular campaigns of the late 1940s, early 1950s, was the More Doctors Smoke Camels Than Any Other Brands. I have some of those ads reproduced on my website, which is cigarettesentry.com. So you could take a look and refresh your memory by looking at some of those ads. I actually did a little bit of research into those ads because they made this claim, More Doctors Smoke Camels Than Any Other Cigarette. And what I found out was that R.J. Reynolds would go to medical meetings, and they would pass out free packages to doctors at the meetings. Then later that day, they'd send in pollsters who would say, "Doctor, what cigarette are you carrying?" The doctors would fish a pack of Camels out of their pockets, and that's how they came up with this statistic that more doctors were smoking Camels.
Now, it was the mid-60s. Wasn't it when the Surgeon General finally, said we've got to put warnings on these cigarettes, this is killing people?
That's right, 1964, the first Surgeon General's report. And it led to legislation in the Congress for a label, but Congress actually diluted the label that the Surgeon General was advocating for, which would have said cigarettes cause lung cancer. Label that appeared in 1965-1966 was caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. And that was just one indication of the influence of the tobacco lobby. But what we now know is they actually wanted some form of weak labeling on cigarettes to protect them against liability litigation. In other words, you've been warned on the package, so don't sue us when you get sick.
You've been warned, but not in strong enough words that might make you quit.
Exactly.
Yeah. That didn't do them a whole lot of good, though, did it?
Well, they were sued, and typically they won the suits. But it just became too much of a strain on Americans' credibility when, as late as the mid-1990s, the companies were saying there is no proof that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer and other diseases. There is no proof that it's addictive. And that's when the companies really got into difficulty in litigation in the 1990s.
Yeah. Let's go to Joe in Monona. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
It's Jim.
I'm sorry, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah. Professor Brandt, I've read a lot of your stuff, and I would like for you to develop for us the way the public relations, especially Hill and Knowlton, developed the attack on science as just another commodity or opinion, and if they could demean science, then they could demean all the efforts to criticize their products. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this is a very interesting question, because when the scientific evidence in the early 1950s proved categorically that smoking causes lung cancer, the industry got together and hired Hill and Knowlton. And in fact, the papers from John Hill and his company, Hill & Knowlton, are actually at the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison, and that's where I use them. And now we really know a lot about that campaign. And what Hill told his clients, the big tobacco companies, was let's start a campaign to create more scientific controversy around this issue. The best thing for you will be not to deny that smoking's harmful, but to say there is no proof, we need more science. So they set up a scientific investigatory panel. They hired scientists. They typically did no research on smoking and its harms. And for several decades, they would put out information which said, we still don't know. The question is still a question. And this is really the first big scientific disinformation campaign in American history. And now we see other industries that understand that uncertainty and controversy is actually in their interest to avoid regulation.
Our guest is Alan Brandt. He is the author of The Cigarette Century, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. 1-800-642-1234 if you would like to join us in Madison 263-1890.
And our final guest today is Nick Naylor. Mr. Naylor is the vice president of the Academy of Tobacco Studies. Now, they are the tobacco industry's main lobby in Washington, D.C., and Mr. Naylor is their chief spokesman. Nick, do you have a question?
Joan, how on earth would Big Tobacco profit off of the loss of this young man? Now, I hate to think in such callous terms, but if anything, we'd be losing a customer. It's not only our hope, it's in our best interest to keep Robin alive and smoking.
That was from the movie Thank You for Smoking, which was sort of a farce on the lobbying efforts of Big Tobacco. Did you catch that movie, Alan Brandt?
I did, and Christopher Buckley's book, Thank You for Smoking, in the movie, as you say, is a great satire on this kind of special interest lobbying. My concern about it is that it has a kind of cynical undertone that we all know that you can't believe anything the tobacco industry tells us. So in some ways, it may encourage us to think, well, they really can't get away with it, but they've come very close to getting away with it.
Yeah. You know, I still hear callers on this program to this day saying that the EPA study that said secondhand smoke was harmful was faulty and that there really isn't any strong scientific evidence that the smoking is directly the cause of all of these deaths. So something's working.
Well, I think you're quite right. And this has really been put out by the industry just as they work to denigrate the evidence in the 1950s that smoking causes lung cancer. They've been tremendously effective at disparaging the evidence that secondhand smoke is actually dangerous to non-smokers. But the scientific evidence on that question is very strong now. And the other question is that if these toxins are in the air, people really don't want to breathe them. So secondhand smoke regulation has been very popular. It's popular in restaurants and bars. It generally has not had a negative impact on the economy. And it's really been transformative. We now live in a very different world as a result of clean indoor air legislation than we did even a generation ago.
You know, the state of Wisconsin is considering legislation that would make a statewide ban of all workplaces, including bars and restaurants. And it is controversial in a state that has a German beer drinking heritage and the tavern. Is this inevitable? Is this going to happen all over the country, do you think, where smoking will be banned in workplaces and public places?
I do think it's happening already. Certain states have already done it. It's interesting because every time a state does it, we always think about some of the cultural reasons why it might not get done or people will resist it. But I followed pretty closely the smoking ban in Ireland. And I had been in Ireland before the smoking ban. You couldn't go into a pub without it being filled with smoke. And now 3 years into it, I was recently talking to some colleagues in Dublin. It's just been remarkable. It's not only been tolerated, it's tremendously popular, and it hasn't had negative impacts on business at all. So if Ireland's pubs can do it, then certainly I think Wisconsin can go ahead and have clean indoor air legislation.
Aaron in Spring Green is with us next. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi. In relationship to the last comment made about banning smoking in restaurants and cafes, my wife and I just recently took a trip to Spain, and we noticed it was very difficult to find any restaurant, eating facility, or even a cafe that was not smoke-filled, and it appeared that a majority of the people were smoking.
Well, it's really true. There's a lot of smoking still in many countries in Western Europe, and varies a lot from city to city and country to country. But I think the overall trend, especially in the developed world right now, is towards these kinds of restrictions. I have a sort of funny story about it. When I was on a plane with one of my kids, and I was explaining about the work I was doing on cigarette smoking, and I told my son, who's asthmatic, I said, you know, people used to be allowed to smoke on airplanes. Mm. And he said to me, you're kidding, that's impossible. And for me, it was just a powerful reminder of how fast and how far we can go towards really cleaning up the environment.
You know, a lot of these changes, it seems, did happen really fast. When I first started working at Wisconsin Public Radio, boy, mid-80s, people were puffing away right here on in a state building in a very, I don't know, very progressive town. And it just seems unreal that that was just, you know, what, 20-some years ago, that people were still smoking away at, you know, in their workplaces. And we have a much, much different attitude today, don't we?
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the most striking aspects of what I'm calling the cigarette century is that there really are some positive stories here. And watching the reduction of smoking, it's a very tough behavior to change, but many people have quit. And now we've really cleaned up a lot of our public spaces from tobacco smoke, which can be harmful to non-smokers.
Yeah. Robin in Grant County is with us. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I tuned in a little late. I'm not sure if you talked about it yet, but I was born in 1955, and I remember as a kid we would walk up to the dairy store to buy penny candy, and you could buy these little packages of candy cigarettes.
Right. I remember
Absolutely.
Those. Yeah.
That's
and,
right.
You know, they were white, and the end was you know, tipped in red dye, and we would sit and smoke these things very elaborately like they did on the movies. And, you know, and that was quite a hook. And I was very keen on smoking as a kid. But then when I was like 8 or 9 years old, it's a very distinct memory. My mother was sitting in the backyard smoking, because both my parents smoked, and I was pestering her to smoke, because I just wanted to smoke so bad. And she said, okay, fine, here you go. And she gave me a cigarette, and I smoked it, and I don't think I inhaled. But it was just such a letdown. And
well, that's the thing. The industry knows that the first cigarette's very tough, so they have to have a strategy to sustain kids through the first few difficult cigarettes. Candy cigarettes has always been a strategy to get kids interested in smoking tobacco. And again, some groups have called for bans to make the sale of candy cigarettes illegal, because they've been shown to encourage kids to experiment with real tobacco. I actually came across an interesting thing in my research about the candy cigarettes, because they often looked very much like a real pack, and so you might have anticipated that the industry would go after the candy manufacturers on trademark violations, but they never bothered at all, because they were very eager for these packages to look as legitimate as possible.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. But now aren't some cigarette manufacturers pushing some sort of flavored tobacco, like, I don't know, pina colada cigarettes?
Yeah, you know, Bahama Breeze and other things like this. And again, it's very clear, adults don't, in a reasoned way, weigh the risks and benefits of smoking and decide in an informed choice to become smokers. Smokers are made as kids and adolescents. The industry knows this, and so even as they say we're only interested in adult smokers, they know there would be no industry if no one started smoking until they were informed, educated adults.
We are talking with Alan Brandt, author of The Cigarette Century, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. Maybe you remember an old cigarette commercial or a way that the tobacco companies used to try to entice you to smoke. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or maybe you just have a thought or question for our guest on the history of the cigarette and the role of the cigarette and the cigarette manufacturer in our culture. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guests will review the major news from the previous week. Ben Marin's after 4. We'll be talking with two guests about a major news story late last week. The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court regarding late-term abortion will be discussed after 4 on At Issue. We are talking about the cigarette, talking with the author of The Cigarette Century, Alan Brandt, who is also a professor of the history of medicine at the Harvard Medical School and is also with the Department of the History of Science.
This is a man who smokes Marlboro cigarettes. What kind of a man is he?
I'm a guy who likes to work on my car. I like to take it apart and put it back together. I get to working on it and forget where I am, what time it is. I even forget to eat.
You don't forget to smoke, though.
I always smoke when I work. They go together.
That was a Marlboro commercial, but that wasn't the Marlboro Man. Was that before or after, do you think, Alan Brandt?
Well, I think that probably was an early Marlboro Man commercial, the macho idea, deep voice, and they fixed on the cowboy. Kind of in the early years of the campaign, that was the Marlboro Man who really took off. But they were trying lots of things from mechanics to sailors early on. And it's a really fascinating story because they transformed a woman's cigarette, Marlboro's, which had been produced since the 1920s, for women with the slogan, "Ivory tips protect the lips," to making this a macho man's filter cigarette, which was really the challenge of the 1950s in the face of all the health evidence. And it really shows you just how malleable and elastic marketing could be, that you could take one brand and turn it into something so radically different.
So I'm thinking of the Marlboro Man as being the cowboy galloping around, and there were many different Marlboro Men. Anybody that was macho was a Marlboro Man.
The Marlboro Man campaign started in the mid-1950s when Philip Morris decided that the future would be in filters, but filters were thought to be effeminate and appeal mostly to women. So they wanted to solve the problem of this identity of filtration. And even though they knew filters did not make cigarettes safe, they came up with this new product, a filtered cigarette that would be pitched to men. And I think in the cowboy they figured, here's somebody who won't read all the evidence, isn't concerned what other people are saying, is going to express himself independently. He's a loner on the range. So in this sense, I think Marlboros were very much tied to the emerging health evidence and said, don't believe what you read, you're a loner, do what you want. And that was really the great appeal of Marlboros.
Yeah, then the guy, the actor portraying the cowboy Marlboro Man died of lung cancer, didn't he?
That's right, and a number of the models and the actors who were the Marlboro Men ended up with emphysema or lung cancer, because they were regular and heavy smokers.
Yeah. What impact did that have, if any, on people smoking when an icon like that dies?
Well, this is always the tough part. It's so easy to get the Marlboro Man out there because the industry has such phenomenal resources. Even today, they're spending $15 billion in the U.S. alone promoting cigarettes. When public health forces want to tell everyone the Marlboro Man just died of cancer, they just don't have the access to the media that the companies have had. So while I think it did become known, it was nothing compared to the barrage of these cowboys riding off into the West herding cattle.
We'll go back to the phones. Jim and Abrams, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I can remember when when there was a time when, oh, by the way, the macho guy with this forgetting what he does except smoke and work on his car, maybe it was affecting his brain.
Maybe.
I remember a time also when it was the intellectual thing to do, especially on the college campus, for the profs and the students that were pipe smokers, and that portrayed an image of if you're this cool intellectual pipe smoker, that you must, you know, have it all together or something. I also remember, so that's really made me skeptical of how the intellectual community in general probably had a lot of other issues simply because of how that appeared or what they did in those days. I also remember that my father-in-law used to tell me that the history of cigarettes smoking in this country developed when the government, or the army, which is the same thing, would get these sample cigarettes from the tobacco companies.
Yeah.
And I think there'd be three or four of them to a pack or something, and that's how they hooked a lot of people.
Right, yeah, we talked about that a little earlier in the program, Jim, but maybe not the specifics on how the military hooked people. They were kind of in cahoots with the cigarette manufacturers, Alan Brent?
Well, I think the industry always mm-hmm. knew that if it could give out free cigarettes or get soldiers to smoke together, that it would have a great consumer in the future. Mm-hmm. And so they were very liberal about discounting to the military. The military sold cigarettes at a great discount in the PX and so on.
Yeah. What about the intellectual image of smoking, especially pipe smoking?
Well, I think that the idea of smoking being associated with intellectual activity mm-hmm. was a very big issue going all the way back into the early 20th century. The idea that people in the arts and literature, people of intellectual mind would smoke was very popular. And actually in the 1920s, people did a study of it, and they said, are people who are smart really more likely to be smokers? And they said, smoking really has no benefits for intellectual life. But this was widely perceived. And on college campuses, I remember I have photographs of people smoking in seminars. Everyone in the room, mm-hmm. the professor and the students, are all smoking as they conducted a seminar. And it's just so far from where we are today that it's a powerful reminder of some of the changes.
We didn't talk a whole lot about how so many Hollywood movies in mid-century where everybody was smoking and it was glamorous to smoke and sexy to smoke.
Yeah, well, this is a very big part of the story. And again, it didn't just happen by chance. The industry was right there talking to directors, getting involved mm-hmm. in Hollywood, hiring celebrities to endorse their particular brand, and it really locked in the idea of smoking in the culture. So again, in the book, I have some reproductions from great American films where everyone's smoking. You can't find a photograph of Bogart or Bacall without mm-hmm. cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry perfected what now we call product placement. They would pay the big movie companies to use their particular branded product in their films. One of the things we've just recently found is that actually smoking has been going up in films over the last 10 or 15 years, and that it's a very attractive element for helping initiate kids into smoking. So there's an important campaign going on to get Hollywood to be more responsible about this and put an R rating on films that show a lot of smoking.
Yeah. Artis in Delafield is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been a nurse for almost 20 years, and I remember at the beginning of my career in the late 80s and early 90s when we allowed smoking in hospital rooms and pairing up, for example, an asthmatic and somebody didn't tell the admissions people that they were a smoker, and they would light up with a person in the next bed on 100% oxygen. So it's kind of interesting to believe that we even allowed that from a practical as well as a hazard standpoint.
I remember I was in an oxygen tent in the hospital when I was 12 years old for something, and the nurses would have to remind people, no smoking in this room. It's just amazing that was allowed.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Yeah.
It is. It's amazing. And now, of course, hospitals are virtually completely smoke-free zones.
Yeah. How did that happen? I mean, this was It was past the mid-60s. It was past the Surgeon General's report. Why did it take so long to get smoking out of public places, hospitals in particular?
Well, I think it's a very big question, and smoking had become so normative and so dominant that people just anticipated it would take place anywhere and everywhere. But I think one of the big things that changed was the evidence on secondhand smoke. Because before that, in our culture, there is this idea, well, it's my body and I'll do as I please. And the industry understood this and encouraged that idea. You know, if you want to smoke, you have the right to. And they talked about this in terms of rights. But when the evidence started to show that smoking was harmful to non-smokers, it really led to radical changes in our environment that began to make smoking much less appealing also for smokers. And many began to quit and look at ways of quitting. And the pleasure and the positive associations of smoking were really eroded. And so smokers would say, it's no longer any fun. I can't do it where I want to. People don't do it together anymore. I'm going to quit. And that was good for smokers, and it's been good for American society. But I think the big change centered on the idea of risk to others.
Yeah. Where are we now in terms of cigarette consumption?
Well, we're down to about 1 in 5 adults in the United States being a regular smoker. Just over 20% are regular smokers. It's still a very big number, and there's much more that we need to do to help those smokers who want to. Most smokers do want to quit. And if we had better strategies and better services for cessation, we could get that number down a lot. One of the big concerns is that smoking has declined here in the United States and other developed countries. The industry has worked so aggressively to market cigarettes in the developing world.
Yeah, and smoking worldwide is more or less than 20%?
Oh, it's more, and in fact, in some countries among men, in China, well over half of all men are regular smokers. China is a giant center of smoking and will increasingly become a center of smoking-related diseases. There are probably more smokers worldwide today than ever before in human history. And that's really the problem, is that as we've gotten a handle on the problem in the United States, the industry has done such a good job of finding what they call replacement smokers abroad.
Joe in Oshkosh is with us now. Hi, Joe.
Hi. You've talked about some of the larger, so to speak, forms of advertising, TV commercials and so forth, but I'm interested in the smaller types that kind of co-opt the everyday person into advertising, or the small businesses into advertising for the industry. You know, you used to be able to go into like convenience stores and see even the push-pull signs on doors and ashtrays and T-shirts and all of these things, which are seen every day by thousands of people, including kids, that make it seem like or that reinforce the idea that smoking is a socially normative behavior. And so when kids, and this used to come up on surveys, you'd ask kids what percentage of adults they think smoke. And even though the percentage was down around in the 20%, most kids would perceive that that over 50% of the adults smoked in our population, therefore making it seem to them that it was socially normative behavior. And I think a lot of these smaller types of advertising did a lot to push that notion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're making an excellent point. And you can just imagine if you went into a drugstore and rather than seeing all the cigarettes lined up behind the druggist or the salesperson, if they were all behind the counter and you couldn't see them, that would be a big public health benefit. And the industry is very shrewd. When ads came off the electronic media, radio, and TV, they figured out how to better use print media. When print media becomes more restricted, they're very good at advertising on the internet or getting cigarettes into clubs. So they're always looking for the next edge in how to promote their product. And it remains a very prominent product that in many ways continues to be well advertised in the United States.
Thank you, Joe. Susan in Shell Lake is with us now. Hi.
Hi. I just have a quick comment wondering about the association between bowling industry, which was huge in Wisconsin, and they are bemoaning its demise. And I wonder what it has to do with people leaving because of the smoke, which is why I left. And then I have a second question or comment. My cousin has started on a new medicine to help her quit smoking, brand new. And it's working. She's in day 15. And has nothing else has worked before.
Well, I'm good for her. I'm not, but the bowling question. You wonder if there's
the association between its failure or demise.
I don't know if bowling's actually failing, but maybe know anything about that, Professor Brandt?
Well, I mean, I know of this work, for example, that shows that community activities like bowling have been eroding in the face of television, video games, and other things that we used to do together. There's a well-known book called Bowling Alone by a legal scholar named Robert Putnam. And so I think there is some view that it has declined. There's no reason why with bowling we couldn't have smoke-free bowling lanes and make it a community activity that really was healthy as opposed to one in which all of us remember these smoke-filled lanes.
Yeah. Lots of new research into and efforts to help people to quit smoking, but it's still apparently a pretty hard thing to do, Alan Brandt?
Yes, in fact, the University of Wisconsin is really a center for developing better strategies for smoking cessation, and they have a great research and clinical program there to try to figure out strategies to help people who want to quit. And as your caller mentioned, there are increasingly better combinations of pharmacologic agents, counseling, as well as supportive strategies for smokers who want to quit. But we really need to push this harder. We need both better medical techniques, and then we need to make sure that people who want to quit have access and resources to engage those best strategies for quitting.
Well, I almost hate to leave it here. We have lots of callers who want to still talk with you about this, but we are at the end of the hour. Professor Brandt, you have a website with more information and some clips and other information for people?
Yes, and it has some of the tobacco documents easily accessible so people can see some of the materials that I based my findings on. It's at cigarettecentury, all one word, .com.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Alan Brandt, author of The Cigarette Century, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. Alan Brandt, also a professor of the history of medicine and the history of science at Harvard University. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production and production assistance. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.